Jean told me her idea. For her to write her own words down and then show me what she's written. I tried to act excited, but I know I'll have to rewrite everything she's written, wasting even more time. I thought it might make it easier if she could see it in typeface instead of me reading it and telling her it can't work this way. We smile at each other. I take a sip of my Coke, smooth my blouse. So, I say. Abilene has a wire-ringed notebook in front of her.
Want me to just go ahead and read?
Sure, I say. We both take deep breaths and she begins reading in a slow, steady voice.
My first white baby to ever look after was named Alton Carrington Spears. It was 1924, and I just turned 15 years old. Alton was a long, skinny baby, with hair fine as silk on a corn.
I begin typing as she reads, her words rhythmic, pronounced more clearly than her usual talk.
Every window in that filthy house was painted shut on the inside, even though the house was big, with a wide green lawn. I knew the air was bad. Felt sick myself.
Hang on, I say. I've typed wide green. I blow on the typing fluid. Retype it. Okay, go ahead.
When the mama died, 6 months later, she reads, of the lung disease, they kept me on to raise Alton until they moved away to Memphis. I loved that baby, and he loved me. And that's when I knew I was good at making children feel proud of themselves.
I hadn't wanted to insult Abilene when she told me her idea. I tried to urge her out of it over the phone. Writing isn't that easy. And you wouldn't have time for this anyway, Abilene, not with a full-time job.
Can't be much different than writing my prayers every night.
It was the first interesting thing she'd told me about herself since we'd started the project, so I'd grabbed the shopping pad in the pantry.
You don't say your prayers, then?
I never told nobody that before. Not even Minnie. Find I can get my point across a lot better writing 'em down.
So this is what you do on the weekends? I asked. In your spare time? I liked the idea of capturing her life outside of work, when she wasn't under the eye of Elizabeth Leifold.
Oh, no. I write an hour, sometimes two, every day. Lot of ailing, sick people's in this town.
I was impressed. That was more than I wrote on some days. I told her we'd try it just to get the project going again. Abilene takes a breath, a swallow of Coke, and reads on. She backtracks to her first job at 13, cleaning the Francis I silver service at the governor's mansion. She reads how on her first morning, she made a mistake on the chart where you filled in the number of pieces so they'd know you hadn't stolen anything.
I come home that morning, after I'd been fired, and stood outside my house with my new work shoes on, the shoes my mama paid a month's worth of light bill for. I guess that's when I understood what shame was, and the color of it, too. Shame ain't black, like dirt, like I always thought it was. Shame be the color of a new white uniform your mother ironed all night to pay for. White, without a smudge or a speck of work dirt on it.
Abilene looks up to see what I think. I stop typing. I'd expected the stories to be sweet, glossy. I realize I might be getting more than I'd bargained for. She reads on.
So I go on and get the shiver robe straightened out, and before I know it, that little white boy done cut his fingers clean off in that window fan I asked her to take out 10 times. I never seen that much red come out a person, and I grabbed the boy. I grabbed them four fingers, towed him to the colored hospital 'cause I didn't know where the white one was. But when I got there, a colored man stopped me and say, "Is this boy white?"
The typewriter keys are clacking like hail on a roof. Abelina's reading faster, and I'm ignoring my mistakes, stopping her only to put in another page. Every 8 seconds, I fling the carriage aside.
And I say, "Yes, sir." And he say, "Is them his white fingers?" And I say, "Yes, sir." And he say, "Well, you better tell him he your high yellow, 'cause that colored doctor won't operate on a white boy in a Negro hospital." And then a white policeman grabbed me and he say, "Now, you look a here."
She stops, looks up. The clacking ceases. "What? The policeman said look a here what?"
"Well, that's all I put down. Had to catch the bus for work this morning."
I hit the return and the typewriter dings. Abilene and I look each other straight in the eye. I think this might actually work. Chapter 12. Every other night for the next 2 weeks, I tell Mother I'm off to feed the hungry at the Canton Presbyterian Church, where we, fortunately, know not a soul. Of course, she'd rather I go down to the First Presbyterian, but Mother's not one to argue with Christian works, and she nods approvingly, tells me on the side to make sure I wash my hands thoroughly with soap afterward. Hour after hour, in Abilene's kitchen, she reads her writing and I type, the details thickening, the baby's faces sliding into focus. At first, I'm disappointed that Abilene is doing most of the writing, with me just editing. But if Mrs. Stein likes it, I'll be writing the other maid's stories, and that will be more than enough work. If she likes it, I find myself saying this over and over in my head, hoping it might make it so. Abilene's writing is clear, honest. I tell her so.
"Well, look who I've been writing to," she chuckles. "Can't lie to God."
Before I was born, she actually picked cotton for a week at Longleaf, my own family's farm. Once she lapses into talking about Constantine without my even asking.
"Law, that Constantine could sing. Like a purebred angel standing in front of the church. Give everybody chills, listening to that silky voice of hers. And when she wouldn't sing no more after she had to give her baby to..."
She stops. Looks at me. She says,
"Anyway."
I tell myself not to press her. I wish I could hear everything she knows about Constantine, but I'll wait until we've finished her interviews. I don't want to put anything between us now. "Any word from Minnie yet?" I ask. "If Mrs. Stein likes it," I say, practically chanting the familiar words. "I just want to have the next interview set up and ready." Abilene shakes her head.
"I asked Minnie 3 times and she still says she ain't gonna do it. I spec it's time I believed her."
I try not to show my worry. "Maybe you could ask some others? See if they're interested?" I am positive that Abilene would have better luck convincing someone than I would. Abilene nods.
"I got some more I can ask. But how long you think it's gonna take for this lady to tell you if she like it?"
I shrug. "I don't know. If we mail it next week, maybe we'll hear from her by mid-February, but I can't say for sure." Abilene presses her lips together, looks down at her pages. I see something that I haven't noticed before. Anticipation. A glint of excitement. I've been so wrapped up in my own self, it hasn't occurred to me that Abilene might be as thrilled as I am that an editor in New York is going to read her story. I smile and take a deep breath, my hope growing stronger. On our 5th session, Abilene reads to me about the day Treloar died. She reads about how his broken body was thrown on the back of a pickup truck by the white foreman.
"And then they dropped him off at the colored hospital. That's what the nurse told me, who was standing outside. They rolled him off the truck bed and the white man drove away.
Abilene doesn't cry, just lets a parcel of time pass while I stare at the typewriter, she at the warm black tiles. On the sixth session, Abilene says,
I went to work for Miss Leafolt in 1960, when May Mobley 2 weeks old.
And I feel I've passed through a leaden gate of confidence. She describes the building of the garage bathroom, admits she's glad it is there now. It's easier than listening to Hilly complain about sharing a toilet with the maid. She tells me that I once commented that colored people attend too much church. That stuck with her. I cringe, wondering what else I've said, never suspecting the help was listening or cared. One night she says,
I was thinking.
But then she stops. I look up from the typewriter. Wait. It took Abilene vomiting on herself for me to learn to let her take her time.
I was thinking I ought to do some reading. Might help me with my own writing.
Go down to the State Street Library. They have a whole room full of Southern writers. Faulkner, Eudora Welty. Abilene gives me a dry cough.
You know colored folks ain't allowed in that library.
I sit there a second feeling stupid. I can't believe I forgot that. The colored library must be pretty bad. There was a sit-in at the white library a few years ago and it made the papers. When the colored crowd showed up for the sit-in trial, the police department simply stepped back and turned the German shepherds loose. I look at Abilene and am reminded, once again, the risk she's taking talking to me. I'll be glad to pick the books up for you, I say. Abilene hurries to the bedroom and comes back with a list.
I better mark the ones I want first. I've been on the waiting list for To Kill a Mockingbird at the Carver Library near about 3 months now. Let's see.
I watch as she puts check marks next to the books. The Souls of Black Folk by W.E.B. Du Bois. Poems by Emily Dickinson, Annie. The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn.
I read some of that back in school, but I didn't get to finish.
She keeps marking, stopping to think which one she wants next.
You want a book by Sigmund Freud?
Oh, people crazy. She nods. I love reading about how the head work. You ever dream you fall in a lake? He say you dreaming about your own self being born. Miss Frances, who I worked for in 1957, she had all them books.
On her 12th title, I have to know. Abilene, how long have you been wanting to ask me this, if I'd check these books out for you?
A while. She shrugs. I guess I was afraid to mention it.
Did you think I'd say no?
These is white rules. I don't know which ones you following and which ones you ain't.
We look at each other a second. I'm tired of the rules, I say. Abilene chuckles and looks out the window. I realize how thin this revelation must sound to her. For 4 days straight, I sit at my typewriter in my bedroom. 20 of my typed pages, full of slashes and red-circled edits, become 31 on thick Strathmore white. I write a short biography of Sarah Ross, the name Abilene chose, after her sixth-grade teacher who died years ago. I include her age, what her parents did for a living. I follow this with Abilene's own stories, just as she wrote them, simple, straightforward. On day 3, Mother calls up the stairs to ask what in the world I'm doing up there all day, and I holler down, just typing up some notes from the Bible study, just writing down all the things I love about Jesus. I hear her tell Daddy in the kitchen after supper,
she's up to something.
I carry my little white baptism Bible around the house to make it more believable. I read and reread, and then take the pages to Abilene in the evenings, and she does the same. She smiles and nods over the nice parts where everyone gets along fine, But on the bad part, she takes off her black reading glasses and says,
I know I wrote it, but you really want to put that in about the...
And I say, yes, I do. But I'm surprised myself by what's in these stories. Of separate colored refrigerators at the governor's mansion. Of white women throwing two-year-old fits over wrinkled napkins. White babies calling Abilene Mama. At 3 a.m., with only two white correction marks on what is now 27 pages, I slide the manuscript into a yellow envelope. Yesterday, I made a long-distance phone call to Mrs. Stein's office. Her secretary, Ruth, said she was in a meeting. She took down my message that the interview is on its way. There was no call back from Mrs. Stein today. I hold the envelope to my heart and almost weep from exhaustion, doubt. I mail it at the Canton P.O. the next morning. I come home and lie down on my old iron bed, worrying over what will happen. If she likes it. What if Elizabeth or Hilly catches us at what we're doing? What if Abilene gets fired, sent to jail? I feel like I'm falling down a long spiral tunnel. God, would they beat her the way they beat the colored boy who used the white bathroom? What am I doing? Why am I putting her at such risk? I go to sleep. I have nightmares for the next 15 hours straight. It's 1:15, and Hilly and Elizabeth and I are sitting at Elizabeth's dining room table, waiting on Luann to show up. I've had nothing to eat today except Mother's sexual correction tea, and I feel nauseous. Jumpy. My foot is wagging under the table. I've been like this for 10 days, ever since I mailed Abilene's stories to Elaine Stein. I called once, and Ruth said she passed it on to her 4 days ago. But still I've heard nothing.
Is this not just the rudest thing you've ever heard of?
Hilly looks at her watch and scowls. This is Luann's second time to be late. She won't last long in our group with Hilly around. Abilene walks in the dining room, and I do my best not to look at her for too long. I'm afraid Hilly or Elizabeth will see something in my eyes.
Stop jiggling your foot, skater. You're shaking the whole entire table, Hilly says.
Abilene moves around the room in her easy, white uniformed stride, not showing even a hint of what we've done. I guess she's grown deft at hiding her feelings. Hilly shuffles and deals out a hand of gin rummy. I try to concentrate on the game, but little facts keep jumping in my head every time I look at Elizabeth. About May Mobley using the garage bathroom. How Abilene can't keep her lunch in the Leifolds refrigerator. Small details I'm privy to now. Abilene offers me a biscuit from a silver tray. She fills my iced tea like we are the strangers we were meant to be. I've been to her house twice since I mailed the package to New York. Both times to trade out her library books. She still wears the green dress with black piping when I come over. Sometimes she'll slip off her shoes under the table. Last time she pulled out a pack of Montclairs and smoked right there with me in the room, and that was kind of something, the casualness of it. I had one too. Now she is clearing away my crumbs with the sterling silver scraper I gave to Elizabeth and Raleigh for their wedding.
Well, while we wait, I have some news,
Elizabeth says, and I recognize the look on her face already, the secretive nod, one hand on her stomach.
I'm pregnant.
She smiles, her mouth trembling a little.
That's great, I say.
I put down my cards and touch her arm. She truly looks like she might cry.
When are you due?
October.
Well, it's about time, Hilly says, giving her a hug. May Mobley's practically grown.
Elizabeth lights a cigarette, sighs. She looks down at her cards.
We're all real excited.
While we play a few practice hands, Hilly and Elizabeth talk about baby names. I try to contribute to the conversation.
Definitely Raleigh, if it's a boy, I add.
Hilly talks about William's campaign. He's running for state senate next year, even though he has no political experience. I'm grateful when Elizabeth tells Abilene to go ahead and serve lunch.
When Abilene comes back in with the gelatin salad, Hilly straightens in her chair.
Abilene, I have an old coat for you and a sack of clothes from Mrs. Walter's house.
She dabs her mouth with her napkin.
So you come on out to the car after lunch and pick it all up, all right?
Yes, ma'am.
Don't forget now. I can't worry with bringing them by again.
Oh, now, isn't that nice of Miss Hilly, Abilene?
Elizabeth nods.
You go on and get those clothes right after we're done.
Yes, ma'am.
Hilly raises her voice about 3 octaves higher when she talks to colored people. Elizabeth smiles like she's talking to a child, although certainly not her own. I'm starting to notice things. By the time Luann Templeton shows up, we've finished our shrimp and grits and are just starting on dessert. Hilly is amazingly forgiving. Luann was late, after all, because of a league duty. Afterward, I tell Elizabeth congratulations again, walk out to my car. Abilene is outside collecting her gently used coat from 1942, and old clothes that, for some reason, Hilly won't give to her own maid, Yule May. Hilly strides over to me, hands me an envelope.
For the newsletter next week. You'll be sure and get it in for me?
I nod and Hilly walks back to her car. Just as Abilene opens the front door to go back in the house, she glances back my way. I shake my head, mouth the word, nothing. She nods and goes on in the house. That night I work on the newsletter, wishing I was working on the stories instead. I go through the notes from the last league meeting and come across Hilly's envelope. I open it. It is one page written in Hilly's fat, curly pen. Hilly Holbrook introduces the Home Help Sanitation Initiative, a disease preventative measure. Low-cost bathroom installation in your garage or shed for homes without such an important fixture. Ladies, did you know that 99% of all color diseases are carried in the urine? Whites can become permanently disabled by nearly all of these diseases because we lack immunities coloreds carry in their darker pigmentation. Some germs carried by whites can also be harmful to coloreds, too. Protect yourself. Protect your children. Protect your help. From the Holbrooks, we say you're welcome. The phone rings in the kitchen, and I practically fall over myself racing to it. But Pascagoula has already answered it.
Miss Charlotte residence.
I stare her down, watch as tiny Pascagoula nods, says,
Yes, ma'am, she here,
and hands me the phone.
This is Eugenia,
I say quickly. Daddy's in the fields and Mother's at a doctor's appointment in town, so I stretch the black twisting phone cord to the kitchen table.
Elaine Stein here.
I breathe deep. Yes, ma'am. Did you receive my package?
I did,
she says, and then breathes into the phone a few seconds.
This Sarah Ross. I like her stories. She likes to kvetch without complaining too much.
I nod. I don't know what kvetch means, but I think it must be good.
But I still stand by my opinion that a book of interviews ordinarily wouldn't work. It's not fiction, but it's not nonfiction either. Perhaps it's anthropological, but that's a ghastly category to be in.
But you liked it?
Eugenia,
she says, exhaling her cigarette smoke into the phone.
Have you seen the cover of Life magazine this week?
I haven't seen the cover of my Life magazine in a month. I've been so busy.
Martin Luther King, dear. He just announced a march on D.C. and invited every Negro in America to join him. Every white person, for that matter. This many Negro and white people haven't worked together since Gone with the Wind.
Yes, I did hear about the marching event, I lie. I cover my eyes, wishing I'd read the paper this week. I sound like an idiot.
My advice to you is write it and write it fast. The march is in August. You should have it written by New Year's.
I gasp. She's telling me to write it. She's telling me...
Are you saying you'll publish it? If I can write it by... I said nothing of the sort. she snaps. I will read it. I look at 100 manuscripts a month and reject nearly all of them.
Sorry, I'll write it, I say. I'll have it finished by January.
And 4 or 5 interviews won't be enough for a book. You'll need 12, maybe more. You have more interviews set up, I assume?
I press my lips together. Some more?
Good, then get it going, before this civil rights thing blows over.
That evening, I go to Abilene's. I hand her 3 more books from her list. My back hurts from leaning over the typewriter. This afternoon, I wrote down everyone I know who has a maid, which is everyone I know, and their maid's name, but some of the names I can't remember.
Thank you. Oh, Lord, look at this.
She smiles and flips to the first page of Walden. Looks like she wants to start reading it right there. I spoke to Mrs. Stein this afternoon, I say. Abilene's hands freeze on the book.
I knew something was wrong. I seen it on your face.
I take a deep breath. She said she likes your stories very much, but she won't say if she'll publish it until we've written the whole thing. I try to look optimistic. We have to be finished just after the new year.
But that's good news, ain't it?
I nod, try to smile.
January.
Abilene whispers and she gets up and leaves the kitchen. She comes back with a Tom's Candy wall calendar. She sets it down on the table, flips through the months. Seem a long way off now, but January ain't but 2, 4, 6, 10 pages away.
Gonna be here before we know it.
She grins. She said we have to interview at least 12 maids for her to consider it, I say. The strain in my voice is starting to really come through.
But you ain't got any other maids to talk to, Miss Skeeter.
I clench my hands. I close my eyes. I don't have anyone I can ask, Abilene, I say, my voice rising. I've spent the last 4 hours poring over this very fact. I mean, who is there? Pascagoula? If I talk to her, Mama will find out. I'm not the one who knows the other maids. Abilene's eyes drop from mine so fast I want to cry. Damn it, Skeeter. Any barrier that had eroded between us these past few months, I've just built back up in a matter of seconds. I'm sorry, I say quickly. I'm sorry I raised my voice.
No, no, it's all right. That was my job. To get the others.
What about Luann's maid? I say quietly, pulling out my list. What's her name? Luvenia? Do you know her? Abilene nods.
I asked Luvenia.
Her eyes are still on her lap.
Her grandson, the one got blinded. She says she real sorry, but she have to keep her mind on him.
And Hilly's maid? Yule May? You've asked her?
She says she's too busy trying to get her boys into college next year.
Any other maids that go to your church? Have you asked them? Abilene nods.
They all got excuses. But really?
They just too scared. But how many? How many have you asked? Abilene picks up her notebook, flips through a few pages. Her lips move, counting silently.
31,
Abilene says. I let out my breath. I didn't know I'd been holding it. That's a lot, I say. Abilene finally meets my look.
I didn't want to tell you,
she says, and her forehead wrinkles,
until we heard from the lady.
She takes off her glasses. I see the deep worry in her face. She tries to hide it with a trembling smile.
I'm gonna ask him again, she says, leaning forward.
All right, I sigh. She swallows hard, nods rapidly to make me understand how much she means it.
Please don't give up on me. Let me stay on the project with you.
I close my eyes. I need a break from seeing her worried face. How could I have raised my voice to her? Abilene, it's all right. We're together on this. A few days later, I sit in the hot kitchen, bored, smoking a cigarette, something I can't seem to stop doing lately. I think I might be addicted. That's a word Mr. Golden likes to use. The idiots are all addicts. He calls me in his office every once in a while, scans the month's articles with a red pencil, marking and slashing and grunting.
That's fine, he'll say. You fine?
I'm fine, I say.
Fine, then.
Before I leave, the fat receptionist hands me my $10 check, and that's pretty much it for my Miss Myrna job. The kitchen is hot, but I have to get out of my room, where all I do is worry because no other maids have agreed to work with us. Plus, I have to smoke in here because it's about the only room in the house without a ceiling fan to blow ashes everywhere. When I was 10, Daddy tried to install one in the tin kitchen ceiling without asking Constantine. She'd pointed to it like he'd parked the Ford on the ceiling.
It's for you, Constantine, so you don't get so hot being up in the kitchen all the time.
I ain't working in no kitchen with no ceiling fan, Mr. Carlton.
Sure you will. I'm just hooking up the current to it now.
Daddy climbed down the ladder. Constantine filled a pot with water.
Go ahead, she sighed. Turn it on, then.
Daddy flipped the switch. In the seconds it took to really get going, cake flour blew up from the mixing bowl and swirled around the room. Recipes flapped off the counter and caught fire on the stovetop. Constantine snatched the burning roll of parchment paper, quickly dipped it in the bucket of water. There's still a hole where the ceiling fan hung for 10 minutes. In the newspaper, I see Senator Whitworth pointing to an empty lot of land where they plan to build a new city coliseum. I turn the page. I hate being reminded of my date with Stuart Whitworth. Pascagoula pads into the kitchen. I watch as she cuts out biscuits with a shot glass that's never shot a thing but short dough. Behind me, the kitchen windows are propped open with Sears, Roebuck and Company catalogs. Pictures of $2 hand mixers and mail-order toys flutter in a breeze, swollen and puckered from a decade of rain.
Maybe I should just ask Pascagoula. Maybe Mother won't find out.
But who am I kidding? Mother watches her every move, and Pascagoula seems afraid of me anyway, like I might tell on her if she does something wrong. It could take years to break through that fear. My best sense tells me, leave Pascagoula out of this. The phone rings like a fire alarm. Pascagoula clangs her spoon on the bowl, and I grab the receiver before she can.
Minnie gon' help us,
Abilene whispers. I slip into the pantry and sit on my flour can. I can't speak for about 5 seconds.
When? When can she start? Next Thursday. But she got some requirements.
What are they? Abilene pauses a moment.
She says she don't want your Cadillac anywhere this side of the Woodrow Wilson Bridge.
All right, I say. I guess I could drive the truck in.
And she say you can't sit on the same side of the room as her. She wanna be able to see you square on at all times.
I'll sit wherever she wants me to. Abilene's voice softens.
She just don't know you as all. Plus, she ain't got a real good history with white ladies.
Whatever I have to do, I'll do it. I walk out of the pantry beaming, hang the phone up on the wall. Pascagoula is watching me, the shot glass in one hand, a raw biscuit in the other. She looks down quickly and goes back to her work. 2 days later, I tell Mother I'm going to pick up a new copy of the King James Bible, since I've worn mine so thin and all. I also tell her I feel guilty driving the Cadillac, what with all those poor starving babies in Africa, and I've decided to take the old truck today. She narrows her eyes at me from her porch rocker.
Where exactly do you plan on buying this new Bible?
I blink.
The
They ordered it for me at the Canton Church.
She nods, watches me the entire time it takes to start the old truck. I drive to Ferris Street with a lawnmower in the back and a rusted-out floorboard. Under my feet, I can see flashes of pavement whiz by.
But at least I'm not pulling a tractor.
Abilene opens the door and I come in. In the back corner of the living room, Minnie stands with her arms crossed over her huge bosom. I've met her the few times Hilly allowed Mrs. Walters to host Bridge Club. Minnie and Abilene are both still in their white uniforms.
Hello, I say from my side of the room. Good to see you again.
Miss Skeeter.
Minnie nods. She settles in a wooden chair Abilene has brought out from the kitchen, and the frame creaks. I sit on the far end of the sofa. Abilene sits on the other end of the sofa between us. I clear my throat, produce a nervous smile. Minnie doesn't smile back. She is fat and short and strong. Her skin is blacker than Abilene's by 10 shades, and shiny and topped, like a pair of new patent shoes.
I already told Minnie how we do in the stories, Abilene says to me. You help me write mine, and her she gonna tell you while you write it down.
Aunt Minnie, everything you say here is in confidence, I say. You'll get to read everything we...
What makes you think colored people need your help?
Minnie stands up, chair scraping.
Why you even care about this? You white!
I look at Abilene. I've never had a colored person speak to me this way.
We are all working for the same thing here, Minnie,
Abilene says.
We just talking.
And what thing is that? Minnie says to me. Maybe you just want me to tell you all this stuff so I get in trouble.
Minnie points to the window.
Medgar Evers, the NAACP officer who lived 5 minutes away, they blew up his carport last night for talking.
My face is burning red. I speak slowly. We want to show your perspective so people might understand what it's like from your side. We hope it might change some things around here.
What you think you gonna change with this? What law you want to reform so we'd say you got to be nice to your maid?
Now hold on, I say. I'm not trying to change any laws here. I'm just talking about attitudes and...
You know what'll happen if people catch us? Forget the time I accidentally used the wrong changing room down at McRae's women's wear. I'd have guns pointing at my house.
There's a still, tight moment in the room, with just the sound of the brown Timex clock ticking on the shelf.
You don't have to do this, Minnie,
Abilene says.
It's all right if you won't change your mind.
Slowly, warily, Minnie settles again in her chair.
I do it. I just want to make sure she understands. This ain't no game we playing here.
I glance at Abilene. She nods at me. I take a deep breath. My hands are shaking. I start with the background questions, and somehow we back our way into talking about Minnie's work. She looks at Abilene as she talks, like she's trying to forget I'm even in the room. I record everything she says, my pencil scratching as fast as I can move it. We thought it might be less formal than using the typewriter.
Then there's one job where I work late every night, and you know what happened.
What's that? I ask, even though she's looking at Abilene.
Oh, Minnie. She catcalls. You the best help we ever had. Big Minnie, we gonna keep you on forever. Then one day she say she gonna give me a week of paid vacation. I ain't had no vacation, paid or unpaid in my entire life. So when I pull up a week later to go back to work, they gone. Moved to Mobile. She tell somebody she scared I'd find new work before she moved. Miss Lazy Fingers couldn't go a day without having a maid waiting on her.
She suddenly stands up, throws her bag on her arm.
I got to go. You give me the heart palpitations talking about this.
And out she goes, slamming the door behind her. I look up, wipe the sweat off my temple.
And that was a good mood,
Abilene says.
Chapter 13. For the next 2 weeks, the three of us arrange ourselves in the same seats in Abilene's small, warm living room. Minnie storms in mad, quiets down as she tells Abilene her story, then rushes out in a rage as fast as she came in. I write down as much as I can. When Minnie lapses into news about Miss Celia, she's sneaking upstairs, think I don't see her. But I know, that crazy lady up to something. She always stops herself, the way Abilene does when she speaks of Constantine. That ain't part of my story. You leave Miss Celia out of this. She watches me until my writing stops. Besides her furiousness at white people, Minnie likes to talk about food.
Let's see. I put the green beans in first. Then I go on and get the pork chops going, 'cause, I like my chops hot out the pan, you know.
One day while she's saying, got a white baby on one arm, green beans in the pot, she stops, cocks her jaw at me, taps her foot.
Half this stuff don't have nothing to do with colored rights. Ain't but day-to-day business.
She eyes me up and down.
Look to me like you just writing life.
I stop my pencil. She's right. I realize that's just what I wanted to do. I tell her, I hope so. She gets up and says she's got more important things to worry about than what I'm hoping for. The next evening, I'm working upstairs in my room, banging the keys on my Corona. Suddenly I hear Mother hit the stairs running. In 2 seconds, she's made it in my room.
Eugene,
she whispers. I stand so fast my chair teeters, trying to guard the contents of my typewriter.
Yes, ma'am?
Now don't panic, but there is a man, a very tall man, downstairs to see you.
Who?
He says his name is Stuart Whitworth.
What?
He said y'all spent an evening together a while back, but how can that be? I didn't know anything.
Christ.
Don't take the Lord's name in vain, Eugenia Phelan. Just put some lipstick on.
Believe me, Mama, I say, putting on lipstick anyway. Jesus wouldn't like him either. I brush my hair because I know it's awful. I even wash the typewriter ink and correcting fluid off my hands and elbows. But I won't change clothes, not for him. Mother gives me a quick up and down in my dungarees and Daddy's old button-up white shirt.
Is he a Greenwood Whitworth or a Natchez?
He's the state senator's son. Mother's jaw drops so far it hits her string of pearls. I go down the stairs, past the assembly of our childhood portraits. Pictures of Carlton line the wall, taken up until about the day before yesterday. Pictures of me stop when I was 12.
Mother, give us some privacy.
I watch as she slowly drags herself back to her room, glancing over her shoulder before she disappears. I walk out onto the porch, and there he is. 3 months after our date, there is Stuart Whitworth himself, standing on my front porch in khaki pants and a blue coat and a red tie like he's ready for Sunday dinner. Asshole.
What brings you here?
I ask. I don't smile, though. I'm not smiling at him.
I wanted to drop by.
Well, can I get you a drink? I ask. Or should I just get you the entire bottle of Old Kentucky? He frowns. His nose and forehead are pink, like he's been working in the sun.
Look, I know it was a long while back, but I came out here to say I'm sorry.
Who sent you? Hilly?
William?
There are 8 empty rocking chairs on my porch. I don't ask him to sit in any of them. He looks off at the west cotton field where the sun is dipping into the dirt. He shoves his hands down in his front pockets like a 12-year-old boy.
I know I was rude that night, and I've been thinking about it a lot, and I laugh then. I'm just so embarrassed that he would come out here and have me relive it.
Now look, he says. I told Hilly 10 times I wasn't ready to go out on any date. I wasn't even close to being ready.
I grit my teeth. I can't believe I feel the heat of tears. The date was months ago. But I remember how secondhand I'd felt that night, how ridiculously fixed up I'd gotten for him.
Then why'd you even show up?
I don't know. He shakes his head. You know how Hilly can be. I stand there waiting for whatever it is he's here for. He runs a hand through his light brown hair. It is almost wiry, it's so thick. He looks tired. I look away, because he's cute, in an overgrown boy kind of way, and it's not something I want to be thinking right now. I want him to leave. I don't want to feel this awful feeling again. Yet I hear myself saying, "What do you mean, not ready?"
Just not ready. Not after what happened.
I stare at him.
You want me to guess? Me and Patricia Van Devender. We got engaged last year, and then I thought you knew.
He sinks down in a rocking chair. I don't sit next to him. But I don't tell him to leave either.
What? She ran off with someone else?
Shoot.
He drops his head down into his hands, mumbles.
That'd be a goddamn Mardi Gras party compared to what happened.
I don't let myself say to him what I'd like to. That he probably deserved whatever she did. But he's just too pathetic looking. Now that all his good old boy, tough bourbon talk has evaporated, I wonder if he's this pathetic all the time.
We'd been dating since we were 15. You know how it is when you've been steady with somebody that long.
And I don't know why I admit this, except that I simply have nothing to lose. Actually, I wouldn't know, I say. I've never dated anybody. He looks up at me, kind of laughs.
Well, that must be it then.
Be what? I steel myself, recalling fertilizer and tractor references.
You're different. I never met anybody that said exactly what they were thinking. Not a woman, anyway.
Believe me, I had a lot more to say. He sighs. When I saw your face out there by the truck,
I'm not that guy. I'm really not such a jerk.
I look away, embarrassed. It's just starting to hit me what he said. That even though I'm different, maybe it's not in a strange way, or an abnormal, tall girl way, but maybe in a good way.
I came by to see if you'd like to come downtown with me for supper. We could talk,
he says and stands up.
We could, I don't know, listen to each other this time.
I stand there, shocked. His eyes are blue and clear and fixed on me like my answer might really mean something to him. I take in a deep breath, about to say yes. I mean, why would I, of all people, refuse? And he bites his bottom lip, waiting.
And then I think about how he treated me like I was nothing. How he got shit-dog drunk. He was so miserable to be stuck with me. I think about how he told me I smelled like fertilizer. It took me 3 months to stop thinking about that comment. No, I blurt out. Thank you. But I really can't imagine anything worse. He nods, looks down at his feet. Then he goes down the porch steps. I'm sorry, he says, the door to his car open. That's what I came to say, and, well, I guess I said it. I stand on the porch, listening to the hollow sounds of the evening, gravel under Stuart's shifting feet, dogs moving in the early darkness. For a second, I remember Charles Gray, my only kiss in a lifetime, how I'd pulled away, somehow sure the kiss hadn't been intended for me. Stuart gets in his car and his door clicks shut. He props his arm up so his elbow pokes through the open window, but he keeps his eyes turned down. Just give me a minute, I holler out to him. Let me get my sweater. No one tells us, girls who don't go on dates, that remembering can be almost as good as what actually happens. Mother climbs all the way to the third floor and stands over me in my bed, but I act like I'm still asleep, because I just want to remember it a while. We'd driven to the Robert E. Lee for dinner last night. I'd thrown on a light blue sweater and a slim white skirt. I'd even let Mother brush out my hair, trying to drown out her nervous, complicated instructions. And don't forget to smile. Men don't want a girl who's moping around all night. And don't sit like some squaw Indian. Cross your... Wait, my legs or my ankle? Your ankles. Don't you remember anything from Mrs. Reimer's etiquette class? And just go ahead and lie and tell him you go to church every Sunday. And whatever you do, do not crunch your ice at the table. It's awful. Oh, and if the conversation starts to lag, you tell him about our second cousin who's a city councilman in Kosciuszko. As she brushed and smoothed and brushed and smoothed, Mother kept asking how I'd met him and what happened on our last date. But I managed to scoot out from under her and dash down the stairs, shaking with wonder and nervousness of my own. By the time Stuart and I walked into the hotel and sat down and put our napkins in our lap, the waiter said they'd be closing soon. All they'd serve us was dessert. Then Stuart had gotten quiet. What do you want, Skeeter? He had asked, and I'd sort of tensed up then, hoping he wasn't planning on getting drunk again. I'll have a Coca-Cola, lots of ice. No, he smiled. I mean, in life, what do you want? I took a deep breath, knowing what Mother would advise me to say. Fine, strong kids, a husband to take care of, shiny new appliances to cook tasty yet healthful meals in. I want to be a writer, I said. A journalist. Maybe a novelist, maybe both. He lifted his chin and looked at me then, right in the eye. I like that, he said, and then he just kept staring. I've been thinking about you. You're smart. You're pretty. You're... He smiled. Tall. Pretty? We ate strawberry souffles and had one glass of Chablis apiece. He talked about how to tell if there's oil underneath a cotton field, and I talked about how the receptionist and I were the only females working for the paper. I hope you write something really good. Something you believe in. Thank you, I hope so too. I don't say anything about Abilene or Mrs. Stein. I haven't had the chance to look at too many men's faces up close,
and I noticed how his skin was thicker than mine, and a gorgeous shade of toast. The stiff blonde hairs on his cheeks and chin seemed to be growing before my eyes. He smelled like starch, like pine. His nose wasn't so pointy after all. The waiter yawned in the corner, but we both ignored him and stayed and talked some more. And by the time I was wishing I'd washed my hair this morning instead of just bathed, and was practically doubled over with gratefulness that I'd at least brushed my teeth, out of the blue, he kissed me. Right in the middle of the Robert E. Lee Hotel restaurant, he kissed me. So slowly, with an open mouth, and every single thing in my body, my skin, my collarbone, the hollow backs of my knees, everything inside of me filled up with light. On a Monday afternoon, a few weeks after my date with Stuart, I stopped by the library before going to the league meeting. Inside, it smells like grade school. Boredom, paste, Lysol, vomit. I've come to get more books for Abilene and check if anything's ever been written about domestic help.
Well, hey there, Skeeter.
Jesus, it's Susie Purnell. In high school, she could have been voted most likely to talk too much. Hey, Susie, what are you doing here?
I'm working here for the league committee. Remember? You really ought to get on it, Skeeter. It's real fun. You get to read all the latest magazines and file things and even laminate the library cards.
Susie poses by the giant brown machine like she's on The Price is Right television show. How new and exciting.
So, what may I help you find today, ma'am?
We have murder mysteries, romance novels, how-to makeup books, how-to hair books. She pauses. Jerks out a smile.
Rose gardening, home decorating.
I'm just browsing, thanks. I hurry off. I'll fend for myself in the stacks. There's no way I can tell her what I'm looking for. I can already hear her whispering at the league meetings.
I knew there was something not right about that Skeeter feeling, hunting for those Negro materials.
I search through card catalogs and scan the shelves, but find nothing about domestic workers. In nonfiction, I spot a single copy of Frederick Douglass, An American Slave. I grab it, excited to deliver it to Abilene, but when I open it, I see the middle section has been ripped out. Inside, someone has written "Nigger Book" in purple crayon. I am not as disturbed by the words as by the fact that the handwriting looks like a third grader's. I glance around, push the book in my satchel. It seems better than putting it back on the shelf. In the Mississippi History Room, I search for anything remotely resembling race relations. I find only Civil War books, maps, and old phone books. I stand on tiptoe to see what's on the high shelf. That's when I spot a booklet, laid sideways across the top of the Mississippi River Valley Flood Index. A regular-sized person would never have seen it. I slide it down to glance at the cover. The booklet is thin, printed on onion-skin paper, curling, bound with staples. Compilation of Jim Crow Laws of the South, the cover reads. I open the noisy cover page. The booklet is simply a list of laws stating what colored people can and cannot do in an assortment of southern states. I skim the first page, puzzled why this is here. The laws are neither threatening nor friendly, just citing the facts. No person shall require any white female to nurse in wards or rooms in which Negro men are placed. It shall be unlawful for a white person to marry anyone except a white person. Any marriage in violation of this section shall be void. No colored barber shall serve as a barber to white women or girls. The officer in charge shall not bury any colored persons upon ground used for the burial of